Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric here with IRAC Veteran 8888. Today, we've got another Gun Gripe episode for you. And today, as my guest co-host, I have Sir Michael Singleton from Guns Out TV.
Thanks for having me, bro. This is my second one. Yeah. Hey, I'm excited. The first one was really fun. We talked a lot of politics, but I think this conversation will be a little different today.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you coming down.
Yeah,
so
thanks, Eric.
I was talking to Sherm, you know, look, things get stressful. We've been talking about wanting to get together and cut some content and just hang and have a good hangout. So he flew down from D.C. to hang out. So we obviously want to take the opportunity to film some content together while he's here.
Yeah, why not? I mean, hey, we're not together as much as we would like to. So I think it's kind of cool that we get to shoot some guns, hang out.
Yeah.
Work out.
You got some working out.
Yeah, man. A lot of working out, which is kind of, which is nice.
Yeah, man. So we've been kind of like kicking around some ideas, and we came up with a great idea for Gun Gripe, and you know, we're going to elaborate on this, of course. But so how important is the Second Amendment to America in general, right? Like your average dyed-in-the-wool average person who's just going about their business on a daily basis. Let's say that, you know, maybe they're not super engaged in social media. Maybe they're not super political. Like they don't pay attention to like gun laws that might be passing or things that are going through legislature and at the state level. You know, maybe they own a gun. Maybe they don't. Maybe they're indifferent about gun ownership. So we're going to elaborate on these things. And I thought that would be a really interesting topic because Sir Michael does so much with all of this political analysis and data and statistics. This will be a great opportunity for us to elaborate on it. Before we get started, I would like to thank our friends at CMMG for supporting our videos. If you want some awesome American muscle in the AR world, look no further. If you use the code IV8888, you can get yourself a nice discount. You guys have seen our Mark 47 meltdown, our AR-22 kit that we melted down, and we've done a lot of stuff with their Descent line, which is their bufferless system. So really great group of people. They're made right here in America. Check them out, CMMG, and a big thanks to them for supporting our efforts here on the channel. Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll elaborate on this a little bit. I mean, I know we have varying, you know, opinions on this, but do you think the average person, are the anti-gun and pro-gun groups operating within an echo chamber?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I think the two groups are somewhat ancillary to the overall concerns of most Americans. I mean, when you know, being a political strategist, I'm always looking at data because data is important for me on the electoral side, meaning, you know, people getting reelected for office, but also on the policy side, because data sort of drives what people's interests are, what their concerns are, but most primarily, and I think probably centrally focused out of those two, what their needs are. And when you look at data from people, most Americans, regardless of their ethnicity, regardless of what parts of the country they live in, guns doesn't even rank in the top 10, believe it or not. They just don't. And the only time that you really do see measured, and I want to be clear on this, the only time you can sort of measure people's focus or interest on guns is usually when there's an uptick in crime. And as you know, that's not consistent. Or when there's a major school shooting. And you see the national conversation typically becomes about AR-15s. And then when you poll during those moments, then you will see people say, oh my God, we need to address this issue, or they're concerned about the issue. But generally speaking, those two things don't happen every day. Not to the magnitude where it's a part of the ongoing dialogue in Washington or the ongoing dialogue in media. And so, Eric, to answer that question, you know, I think whether it's the folks who want further restrictions on certain types of firearms or guns in general, or the individuals who find themselves on the side and they're advocates of the Second Amendment, or they're advocates of firearms and firearms education, I kind of feel like those two groups are pretty much in a silo, sort of battling each other. And you know, in as a, I guess, an aspect of the overall American pantheon of ideas, but I certainly wouldn't put it in the top 10 of that pantheon of ideas and concerns and needs that the average American has. And it's really interesting when you think about it.
You know, I would be curious for Michael to know if the media were to report, let's just say, situations where a good guy with a gun actually makes a difference, just as, you know, with much zest and enthusiasm.
As the other stories.
Right. As they report all the bad stuff, mm-hmm. if people wouldn't go, well, wait a minute, like guns save a lot of lives. And like, we're seeing a lot more situations where people are using guns to defend themselves than when some isolated incident happens, like mm-hmm. a shooting, which as tragic as that is.
Sure.
The fact of the matter is the world is a violent place. So, like mm-hmm. human nature is violent, you know, and people were pushed to some really extreme circumstances in their lives that caused them to commit violence. And those are terrible things. Like, obviously we want to avoid those things when we can, mm-hmm. Without going really down the rabbit hole super far. My argument could also, you know, be placed that like a school shooter doesn't just pop up overnight. Like they're sort of, they become that person through a wide set of different circumstances, right? The way they were raised, maybe the medication they're on, maybe their interactions with people.
You do see behavioral. I mean, it's interesting, but you say that point because every time, and I don't want to minimize these shootings. I mean, they're horrible. And I think you and all of the viewers would agree with that. But I think to the point that you're making, you can see behavioral changes in many of these young people. And we know that because oftentimes when these shootings happen and you talk to friends or other classmates or maybe even the teachers, and oftentimes you'll see the reports, Eric, and you know this, you follow these stories where they're saying, well, you know, for the past 2 years, they were having behavioral problems. Or you look at that particular student's records and then you see they've been suspended countless times or they have had multiple encounters with law enforcement or other entities that are involved with sort of checking students' behavior. And so when these incidents happen, you know, you sort of have to ask, well, why did so many people miss all of these red clues? Why didn't the parents say, well, clearly there's something wrong here? Or did the administrators do enough to say, hey, you know, this kid isn't right. We need to notify the parents. And if the parents aren't going to do anything, then maybe we should notify law enforcement. Hey, we're concerned that this student is displaying behavior that could lead to some type of a massacre to harm other students and other teachers. And oftentimes, all of those red signs, people just ignore them, man. And it's an unfortunate reality.
You know, when you think about like all the stuff that winds up happening in the media with these types of events mm-hmm. and the way that they're really politicized, and of course they use it as an immediate trope
politics,
to sort of
you know.
Call for, you know, for some form of change or whatever. Again, as I go back to saying that, you know, if we saw more positive things reported, would the national view of guns be a little bit more important in people's lives once they understood that, you know, hey, there's people that actually, you know, protect themselves and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, we are fighting an uphill battle in terms of being, you know, pro-gun people. And it is a cultural thing.
Like
is definitely, you know, laws are always downstream from culture, as many say.
Yeah.
And that's true. It's like, so what we try to do with our channel is really change the culture of gun ownership. Now, granted, you know, I do some silly stuff like the meltdowns and all, but I also do a lot of educational stuff. Yeah. We do our top five videos where we're trying to, you know, show people cool stuff and comparisons, and we do versus videos and reviews mm-hmm. and we put educational stuff out there, safety. So, also like reloading and gunsmithing, mm-hmm. like kind of self-sufficiency.
Really, really cool stuff, man. I watch
we
all
try
your
to be
videos.
Well-rounded, right? So, I'd like to think that most gun owners that are really dyed-in-the-wool type gun owners, mm-hmm. you know, they all tend to kind of be that way, you know? And
yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, look, Eric, people have jobs. They're trying to take care of themselves, their families. I mean, like I told you, so Eric and I talked about this in the car. And he said, Sherman, do you think people think about this? I said, Eric, most people are just going about their business. Most people aren't. I don't think most Americans want to take anyone's guns away. I think you have Americans who say, well, hey, maybe I want to get a gun because I live in a place where the crime is sort of high. I think you have some Americans who say, you know, I don't really care for guns, but if people want to own guns and they're safe and their education know about it, I don't particularly care. I think oftentimes in our country in particular, being someone who's often on television, I think we find issues and we put a magnifying glass over them and we sort of blow them up and make them far greater than what they actually are. I mean, we have a country of over 300 million people. Think about that. It's a lot of people. Let's say 250 million of them are 18 and above. And I don't know. I'm just throwing out a hypothetical. Do you think most of those people want to take people's guns away? I don't think they do. Even if they don't want to own a gun themselves. But I do think that individuals who may be on the other side of the gun issue, being they want further restrictions or just complete restrictions, have done a masterful job of articulating their message in a way that has the perception that is representative of a third or even half of the country. And being a data guy, I simply said, well, that's not really true. Is there a subset that may indeed feel that way? Absolutely. But is that representative of most people? I don't think so, man. I think most people are like, I have other things to worry about. I don't really care. And that's why I made that point early on where I think we're sort of in this bubble of fighting with the other side. But this is why I think it's important to understand that though. Because the other side has shown to great effect their ability to sort of communicate their position very well. And so even if it's 50% of the country that's like, I'm not really thinking about this, if they can sort of reach that 50% with their message and their message only, then over time, then you will begin to sort of win and pull in people and start to say, well, you should think about this, but you should think about it from my perspective. And that comes to, well, what do people who are gun owners and advocates of the Second Amendment, whether it's training, education, on the laws, et cetera, then what should we do a better, greater job at also articulating our message to the American people of, hey, guns are okay. And as long as you're safe and responsible and you're a legal citizen, everybody should be able to own a gun and you should be able to protect yourself and you should be able to hunt and you should be able to do sporting. You should be able to collect if that's your thing. Or maybe if you're an engineer and you like the building side of firearms, and that should be, you know, we should have a space for that as well. I don't think that we have been as effective. And I don't know, maybe your audience may disagree with me, and I certainly respect people who may differ, but I don't think, Eric, we've been as effective as the other side in articulating our position.
Well, as you said earlier, you know, the Bloomberg bucks certainly help.
Dude,
I mean, like when you've got
$50 million Mike Bloomberg gave in 2014. And some of the estimates that I was looking at preparing for this conversation is that he's given over $100 million to organizations that are, I guess you can say, anti-gun. And that money is used to put money behind legislators, rather, who they think should be elected. They use that money to donate to PACs to support legislators or to try to elect legislators who may share in their beliefs. Mm-hmm. They use that money to reach Americans. Again, going back to my original statement of most Americans don't care, well, they're going to say, well, this is why you should care. That's a lot of money. And so when you have that kind of money and those resources that a 50, 100 plus million dollars allows one to exercise in this sort of political experience that we're all experiencing in real time, then the question sort of becomes for those of us on the opposite side, how do we articulate our message? And sure, you can win the court cases, but are we articulating the importance of those court cases to people outside of our core group?
Yeah,
I don't know if we are.
And are we on the offensive? You know, so that's the thing.
Because being on the defense
is always not on the defensive.
Yeah,
we
got to flip that.
When you have a large entity like, you know, many anti-gun groups that are backed by these billionaires and everything like that.
Mega billionaires.
Yeah. People like Michael Bloomberg and all. You know, they are paying these people, like these folks are taking that money and doing all kinds of things with it. They're able to, you know, buy radio ads and Facebook ads and any type of advertising they need. And so
they're reaching those
people. And
they're
sending people out to go to every single state capital that they're having anything to do with guns. They've got a whole bunch of people sitting around trying to, you know, make it look like there's this big presence. And
Even if they're paying people to show up, by the way. Because as a political person, let me mention this to the audience.
That's what I'm suggesting, that they're probably paying these people.
Yeah, let me mention this. So in politics, oftentimes, when you want to showcase a significant show of force, you'll find a lot of people say, hey, we need you for 2 or 3 hours. We have a budget. We'll pay you $200 to come out with us, or a couple $100 to come out with us for an hour. Wear a shirt, raise some signs, et cetera. And oftentimes you do this. And I'm speaking from the Republican side. We've done this for certain issues that we've cared about because we recognize that human beings are visual. Lawmakers are visual. And so the perception of having a lot of people there makes people start to pay attention. It galvanizes the news media because the media is not going to show up if there's 10 people. But if you got 100 or 200 people, oh my God, this is a news story. And so they do that, again, to my point of how effective they have been with the resources that they have been given to articulate their message to reach people who may not particularly care, who may not feel any kind of way about guns. They have done so with, in my opinion, great reward to their particular cause.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced, Eric, as a political strategist who's concerned about addition versus subtraction. Addition meaning I want to see gains to the things I care about versus losing for the things I care about. I don't think that we have been able to quite figure out a way to target Americans who just may be indifferent.
Yeah.
And with the message of maybe this isn't your issue, but it's an issue that you should at least be informed about. But we also, I don't know how many people are writing gun groups $100 million checks, though. And that stuff matters.
That's right. And, you know, you almost have to wonder when it comes to, you know, that sort of thing. You know, yeah, being on the defensive all the time is a pain in the butt, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and eventually, right, if all you're doing is defending and the enemy is throwing everything they can at you offensively, eventually mm-hmm. you're going to lose some form of ground. It might take a while, and they might lose a lot, but eventually,
former veteran,
all
you
they
know.
Have to do is take a little bit of ground, and to them, that's a victory. So a lot of the anti-gunners, they're going to throw spaghetti at the wall, and they're going to sort of see what sticks, if you will.
And something eventually will.
And I think the way that you reach out to a wider variety of people, mm-hmm. you know, a larger subset of Americans from many, many different backgrounds, quite frankly, with the gun issue, is that their lives have not gotten uncomfortable enough to understand yeah. why guns are important. Yeah. All right. Maybe someone lives a relatively sheltered life, or mm-hmm. maybe they live in an area where crime isn't so bad yet.
Yeah.
You know, all right. Maybe they live in an area where they've never even seen a crime committed. They don't feel the need to carry a gun. Or maybe they live in an area where folks are hunters and like most of their connection with guns are the hunting groups and things mm-hmm. like that. And maybe they don't care about hunting. So therefore, to them, they just view firearms as a tool for hunting. And since they're not into hunting, well, then guns don't matter to me because I don't hunt. Life hasn't gotten uncomfortable enough yet. The government overreach hasn't gotten bad enough. And mm-hmm. I know it's easy to kind of lay that sort of platitude out and say, well, it's and blame, play the blame game. It's not necessarily about playing the blame game. It's just that eventually people will vote with their feet, and they'll always vote with how they feel. Like, I mean, like Napoleon even said, like, you know, an army marches on its stomach, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you can have the biggest army and you can try to move them, but you have to have everything in place to make it happen.
Right,
so when it comes to the level of discomfort that people are feeling right now has not gotten severe enough. Right. When you,
because
you
I think,
see
I think,
in, because in 2020,
I think
people
things,
started buying a lot more guns.
Because of crime. Right. That's what
right.
That's
that, you see how the firearms ownership
making.
Is up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
mm-hmm.
that kind of goes to my point where now you've got this large subset of people who are certainly into guns that were not before because they saw, wow, in 2020, the police aren't going to be there to protect me or whatever. So there's going to have to be enough cataclysms, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So where people go, wow, like this keeps happening. You know, maybe 2020 wasn't enough and they go, eh. You know, maybe that was an isolated
incident. Yeah, because that wave, it went up and now it sort of subsided.
Right. So how many more cataclysms need to occur? How many more times does the pendulum need to swing
mm-hmm.
in either direction before they go, wow, you know what? I may not necessarily be into guns too much, but I'd be dumb not to have one.
Please have one.
I think
for,
that's where
for
a lot
protection.
Of people.
I think so too, Eric. And I think, again, having money allows for a lot of resources to buy resources, to own resources, to reach and target more people. And, you know, as I told you, Eric and I were talking about, you know, wealthy conservative donors. And, you know, he was just kind of like, well, sure, you know, we really don't have any Bloombergs or, I mean, even Elon Musk. I know a lot of conservatives have jumped on the Elon Musk bandwagon. I certainly love his brilliance as far as technological ingenuity is concerned. But even him, he's tweeted about the way he feels about guns. And it probably, it's a position that I don't think many gun people would probably agree, at least not the hardcore ones. And so the point that I'm trying to make is, even if you look at this purely through a political lens, the donors who are on the Republican side, mega donors, I know many of them, having worked on three presidential campaigns, having worked for the Trump administration, for the former president, they're not concerned about guns. That's not a top issue for conservative mega donors. And I know that there are some wealthy donors who do support the Second Amendment. And as you and I discussed, they've written checks of a couple million bucks, but a couple million bucks, it pales in comparison to 50 or 100 million, man. And so that goes to the point that I was making. Even the people with the resources on our ideological side who could write a substantial check, they're concerned about other things and not this one. And so again, that goes to the point that I was saying earlier, Eric, then what do people who are concerned about firearms, what burden, if I'll put it that way, what burden do we have to not only try to reach more Americans who just may be indifferent, but what burden do we have to try to go to some of those conservative billionaire donors mm-hmm. and say, hey, a $5 million, $10 million check isn't enough. We need more, and this is why we need more. And I haven't seen that, Eric.
Well, so getting back to Musk, I think a lot of the reasons that conservatives, mm-hmm. you know, support a guy like Elon
mm-hmm.
is because he's very analytical and he's mm-hmm. very logical.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's the kind of person that he might say something and then a few days later go, oh, well, I researched this and it was wrong, and he'll rescind his statement. So just because he had that view on mm-hmm. guns at that given time,
sure.
he's totally the kind of person that like might look at the data mm-hmm. and go, well, wait a minute, maybe I'm really wrong about this. Maybe this, yeah, no, this isn't as far-reaching.
I'm not trying to
issue.
Hold that against him. I'm just merely using yeah. that as an example.
Well, he's certainly a rich person.
To say
yeah.
super wealthy people.
Yeah, he spent $44 billion
to buy Twitter. Right. So
I'm
just simply using an example to say that super wealthy people, for the most part, have typically mm-hmm. been on the other side of the gun issue
sure.
as far as where they spend their dollars. And I'm just simply drawing a parallel to say on the other side, being the conservative side, we don't really have that. And we have a lot of wealthy people, but they're not putting their money behind this issue.
Think about a donation as an investment, if you will,
sure.
right? An investment
yeah.
in the idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
if I'm a really rich person and I want to donate a ton of money to a pro-gun group to
yeah.
try to get the needle moved, okay, what is my investment getting me? Well, all right, does that mean that we're going to now be on the offensive and actually push hard? Does
mm-hmm.
Congress have the intestinal fortitude to actually do something
yeah.
for guns? And the answer is, as much as I hate to say this, that just like Congress won't even ever touch anti-gun bills, they won't touch pro-gun bills either.
Really
so as long as it's a gun-related topic, they're just going to try to defer it and stay away from it and just
yeah.
simply make it a non-issue. Now, what are investors concerned about? They're concerned about performance. Obviously,
that's
they want
right.
to make sure that their investment is going to yield some type of a return. At least now, obviously, when you're a mega donor and you're putting money into all these PACs and
mm-hmm.
you're, you know, putting money into these gun groups, whether they're anti-gun or pro-gun, whichever side, Bloomberg has to see some value.
Oh, has
in what
to.
He's sending out
yep.
all that money. At mm-hmm. least there's some perceived
some
return,
marginal return
right,
on investment.
Some marginal.
Something.
Now, a return that might be extremely marginal, and in fact, now we're seeing probably marginalized,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
right? We're seeing that a lot of on the state side, right, that many states are passing constitutional carry.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have more states with constitutional carry than we don't have a constitutional
yeah.
carry,
yeah.
right? And we've seen that map change rapidly just over the last few years. So 2020 has showed us that people want to be able to protect themselves
mm-hmm.
out in public and do their thing. And there's public, let's just say, support for things
yeah.
like constitutional carry.
Yeah.
So that's a victory. Right. Now, when you want to look at ill-begotten gains versus, you know, a solid gain, right? We did that on a shoestring budget compared to the
yeah,
folks that are trying to lobby against us with all this money, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
if you can throw all that money towards a problem mm-hmm. and still not get anywhere,
yeah.
and then us with our little shoestring budget,
mm-hmm.
we're actually like getting some good gains.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
should tell you right there that the public perception of guns might
mm-hmm.
actually be more positive than we actually
think. That's what I was saying.
On a more wide-ranging
right, and that's
area.
What I was saying when you and I were talking.
Undecided people.
Earlier, yeah. and I was saying in the car to Eric, Eric was just like, well, it just seems like, you know, like people who are anti-gun just get all of the media attention. And I was like, Eric, I don't think most people care, man. And you just stated all of these states are passing constitutional carry. That's why I said, Eric, I don't think most Americans want to take anyone guns away. I don't believe that. And I'm not saying that we on the conservative side are overreacting. That's not what I'm trying to say. But what I'm trying to say is I just think we buy into these narratives that we see that all these people want to take my gun. Even all these Democrats. No, I know a lot of Democrats who are pro-gun. Now, we may not agree on every issue, but I know quite a few who own guns. And when you look at the data on people who own guns and the diversity on people who own guns, many of these people belong to diverse groups that historically vote democratically over Republicans. So that goes to tell you that this idea of who gun owners are, it's not just one-sided. The idea,
they also know their history.
Right, right. The idea that only some people support gun ownership and those on the other side don't, it's not true. I think that, again, to the point that I was making, $50 million, $100 million allows the ability to buy messaging, to be in front of the cameras, to pay people to show up to your rallies and events. Mm-hmm. And you have that perception that half of Americans do not want AR-15s or half of Americans do not want gun ownership in general. I'm a data guy. That's not true. And look, I always see a lot of, you know, stuff on social media and stuff. And I sometimes laugh because I've been in politics. I've done the job. I don't just go on and just talk about my opinions and what I think. I've actually really done this in real life. Sometimes I've done it successfully. Sometimes we've had some failure, but I've really done it. And so when I look at the numbers, and again, you look at the success overall, and it's just like, more black people own guns today than they ever did. That's why you have black gun groups. Latino people, they have gun groups. Asian people, they have gun groups. Even the LGBT community, they have their own gun group. These are very, very disparate minority groups that are clearly recognizing more people in each of their groups are buying guns. So they're saying, well, we should have our own gun groups. So what does that tell me, Eric? It tells me that more Americans feel differently than what's perceived on television.
Yeah. And what's the common denominator? The common denominator is that they all support the Second Amendment.
There we go. Right?
There's a common ground that can be found there between those people. I want to talk a little bit real quick, not to like kind of change gears, but you know, when we look at what's going on with like the bump stock situation, the brace situation, the frame and receiver rule, all of these, you know, let's just say these little rule-making changes, you know, with the ATF is doing and everything like that. It shows you, if anything, that they are quite desperate to try to get some form of gun control that they can appeal to their base. Like they want to pacify what they, and here's the thing. Maybe they're so out of touch, right? That let's just say the Democrat leadership, like Biden and, and all of his cronies and all, maybe they're so out of touch with what actual Democrats want that they think they're trying to pacify their base by going for gun control. But the reality may be
the loudest voices
that there are actually a lot of Democrats that might be completely
that are okay with guns, that are completely indifferent. No, I mean, you're right.
And it makes them look bad.
Well,
and
let me give you an example.
Is they go, well, we can't go through Congress and actually get any real legislation done in terms of anti-gun and sometimes even pro-gun. I mean, look how hard it's been just to get a vote on House Joint Resolution 44, right? That's like pulling teeth.
Yeah.
And that should be simple, right? Because that, anyway, I digress. The point I'm making, though, is that you know, all Biden can do is go, well, I can't get Congress to do anything on this because the will isn't there. So now we're just going to use executive fiat to try and ram
this through. Well, the ATF, and we've had, I've seen a lot of conversations about the powers of the ATF. And look, I was a cabinet secretary, or not secretary, I was a cabinet appointee who served a cabinet secretary at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So when I say this, and I always like to just tell people my background, so they're like, oh, here's just some random guy with an opinion. No, I'm a guy that's worked in politics, that's had a lot of very prominent positions, worked for a lot of very prominent people. As a cabinet, as a deputy chief of staff working for a cabinet secretary, you really have to understand the machinations of an agency and how agencies work, how agencies govern themselves, the powers that agencies have, and the limitations on said power and the ability to issue regulations. And you can't issue regulations outside of written law by Congress. And so if people are wondering, well, what the hell does that mean, Sure Michael, then let me explain. Well, essentially what I'm saying is that the ATF does not have any constitutional authority to write laws. They just don't. And this is one of the issues where I have that I have with the executive branch and these darn executive orders. Republicans and Democrats have been guilty of this, and I think it's wholly unconstitutional. The Federalist Papers are pretty clear on this. The executive can't issue laws. Congress issues laws because Congress are the indirect representatives of the people. And so the ATF issuing, whether it's the laws on the bans or bump stocks, whatever the case may be, these things are simply unconstitutional merely because they don't have the power to write laws. Is that simple? This isn't complicated stuff. And I think some people have tried to overcomplicate this. Eric, it's not complex. The only entity in our government that can write laws is the legislative branch, the House, thus the Senate, and vice versa. Not any government agency. The powers just are not there by the Constitution.
Well, when you look at Chevron deference, right? I could understand something like Chevron deference being used as a mechanism in some sort of, let's just say, low-key thing that might, maybe it involves a little fine or something, or maybe it involves, you know, just some regulatory minor burden that they don't want to place on Congress, right? Like something minor. But when you're talking something that carries criminal penalties,
it's beyond
aren't just any criminal
scope.
Penalties. Like, we're talking a group of people who can bring guns to your house and hold you at gunpoint and arrest you and put you in jail for 10 years and a $250,000 fine per infraction. Like, that is, if I ain't never heard of a criminal penalty, that's a criminal penalty.
Well, that is beyond the scope of their regulatory power. So to the point that you just made, it's one thing if they issue this or that. So agencies do have the ability and the lawful ability to issue regulations. And what those regulations do is they govern the things that are under the purview of that entity. So let's say HUD example, because I was a deputy of staff there. So HUD, we are over housing, you FHA, Ginnie Mae backed loans, mortgage backed securities. You're talking about over $1 trillion essentially. So HUD can say, let's do Section 8 vouchers. HUD can say, well, Section 8 vouchers falls under the purview of HUD. So therefore HUD will issue a new regulation to say people with Section 8 vouchers can now use those vouchers beyond their city limits. HUD would be within its legal authority to do so because you're not trying to go around the law. But if HUD were to say, well, we're going to issue a regulation that states only people ages 18 to 25 of this demographic group and only women can get Section 8 vouchers. That's unconstitutional because now you're essentially trying to write a law. So when you talk about something like Chevron deference, it's one thing to write a regulation that is with that falls within your purview to sort of govern things, if you will. Yeah. But when you start talking about, well, we're going to now potentially arrest you or give you jail time, then you're talking about a law because now you're saying a judge is going to have to make a decision based off of a regulation from an agency that's not backed by a law passed by Congress that is then signed by a president. And I'm not trying to complicate this, Eric, but what I'm simply trying to say, again, for people who are watching this, it is beyond the scope of their purview as an entity to write regulations, yeah, not laws. Again, that's why it's unconstitutional.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at this whole situation, you know, in order for them to actually say, all right, that braced handguns are covered in this sort of way that they're trying to go, they would have to change the law. And I think that that's why, you know, it's going to probably wind up getting shot down. And I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about it, but like the Cargill the Michael Cargill case, you know, that one's going to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, like we just saw this EPA situation come through where they sided with the fishermen.
Of course.
And they put
did.
A stopper in Chevron deference in that mm-hmm. particular situation. Mm-hmm. So if and, Chevron and, deference.
Did you
was,
read that case, by the way?
A little bit of the summary.
But do you know the genesis of it, though?
Well, yeah, I think that they what they were doing is they were having the government was requiring these fishing boats to have these monitors on them, mm-hmm. and they were having to
the
actually
EPA
pay.
As an agency, not right, Congress,
right. The EPA was mm-hmm. was forcing these fishermen to have government hired mm-hmm. you know people that they had to pay.
And you know what the court said? The court essentially said this is beyond the purview and authority of your agency.
Well, they're forcing you to basically
you're not
hire
Congress.
A person.
And again, this goes to my point, Eric, of what I'm saying. This stuff. We got to kind of deal with it. You got to go through the legal process. And I know so many people are just like, this is ridiculous. But guys, that's the way the system works.
Yeah.
But what I can assure you, as I told people months ago when the stuff first started happening, they said, you're not worried about it? I said, no. They said, why? I said, because I worked at an agency as like the fourth in command. I know the authorities of the agency and where they stop. I know for a fact we can't do things beyond our purview, such as writing law. And so when you look at that EPA case, the courts, and it's complicated, read the ruling if you want, but the genesis of it is, EPA, you don't have the authority to do this. This is beyond the scope of why you exist. And so it's found it unconstitutional. And so I think when this goes to the court, if it gets there, Eric, the court is going to say this is unconstitutional.
Well, now that there's that Supreme Court case in place, mm-hmm. they're going to see that when the
precedent,
they're going to have that precedence mm-hmm. there. And when they see, you know, Mr. Cargill's case mm-hmm. come up, they're going to be like, look, y'all can't do this. Look, Supreme Court's already said this.
Can't.
It's like they're going to shoot it all down.
The
frame and receiver rule, the brace rule, mm-hmm. the bump stock rule.
So I tell people, I know people are freaking out. Guys, relax. It's a pain in the ass, Eric. Excuse me for using that language on your channel. I know it is, guys. But trust me, the law is clear on this, Eric. The Constitution is clear on this. The court just ruled in a case that's not similar as it pertains to firearms, but there's a connection, or the genesis is somewhat the same pertaining to the EPA.
Yeah.
And the court is very clear. A government agency does not have the authority to write law. That rests with Congress. And any time a government authority attempts to usurp Congress by writing law, that is an unconstitutional act. And the court is very clear on that. So we're going to be okay. It's going to take us a little time, Eric, but I promise you we're going
to
be okay.
The interesting thing to sort of like get back to in the original, you know, context of the gun gripe, though, is that, all right, look how nuanced we went into some of those details.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And to think that like the average person doesn't follow this.
Yeah,
and
man.
That was always one of our initial concerns, too, when we saw that this brace situation could potentially affect somewhere the estimates are between 10 and 40 million gun owners, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now you're talking there's 40 million people at large that could potentially be felons and not even know it. Think about how many of those Americans that were fence sitters mm-hmm. when it came to the Second Amendment.
But now their cousin may go to prison.
2020 came around, mm-hmm. and they bought a braced handgun because mm-hmm. they liked a nice compact package to mm-hmm. Protect their home with. And now they're just, you know, their heads in the sand. They're just living their life.
Yeah.
They don't know about all this stuff going on. How many of those people are going to slip through the cracks and get in a bunch of trouble?
A lot of them would slip through.
So that's the issue. It affects, like, it's important that average people that maybe you don't care about the Second Amendment one way or the other, mm-hmm. but you need to know it's your rights. And when your rights are under attack, that's something you need to be aware of, right? I mean, You may not like guns, but it's still your right. And you shouldn't support any environment where your rights are eroded, no matter what it is. You mm-hmm. might not like guns, but it's still mm-hmm. your right. Yeah. You wouldn't want somebody to trample on your freedom of speech or, you know, search and seizure and all mm-hmm. of these other rights that we have. Like this, the Constitution is a set of very important rules, right? These are all things that the government, we're saying the government cannot do. Like it's an instruction sheet of limitations on government. Yeah. And they've somehow spun it around as, oh, well, the Second Amendment, we can regulate this and regulate that. Nah, son. Like the Second Amendment is about preventing the government from mm-hmm. infringing on that right. Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. a post Bruin landscape, it really does change things considerably, right? Because they're going to have to really dig deep. And now the burden of proof is on the government,
Yeah.
to provide all of the information that supports, okay, the longstanding historic text and tradition and all mm-hmm. of that. That supports the laws that are already in place. So could we see eventually the NFA getting shot down?
Mm-hmm.
You know, could we see an environment one day where people can make new machine guns again?
I mean, what about suppressors and the idea of tax stamps? I mean, I don't quite understand how that's constitutional. I don't know why a group hasn't tried to sue about that. I mean,
how can you tax a right?
There's even health benefits to using suppressors. That's why in Europe they sort of recommend that people shoot with suppressors because of the hearing issue. Taxing a right does, well, I probably should be careful with how I word this, but we have seen other laws in the past where entities have attempted to tax people to vote, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Constitution said that's, you can't do that. We have seen other cases where entities have attempted to use other means to sort of curtail people, to prohibit them from doing something or to get them to do something. And the court has, for the most part, consistently said, yeah, you can't do that either. And so, and I'm just using the suppressor thing as an example to just say, yeah, you know, some of these entities go a little too far. And I don't own any suppressors. I've always wanted to get some, but I refuse to pay a tax for something that the Constitution doesn't state I should have to pay a tax on. So I just don't have one. So I just come hang out with Eric and I shoot his suppressors. but you get the point that I'm making, Eric? Now, I will say this, though. I do have one thing that I do think about sometimes, Eric, and I don't know if you've ever thought about this. So we got a conservative court now, and the conservative court overturned Roe versus Wade.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if, and you made this statement, at some point in our conversation, you said that, culture dictates the laws. I think that's how you worded it.
Sure.
What happens when the culture drastically changes? Then we have a liberal court and someone files a lawsuit and then they attempt, or not even attempt, but they do reverse the Bruin decision. Have you thought about that? I've thought about that, Eric.
I have thought about it. And
what are your thoughts on
when
that?
You look at Roe v. Wade,
I'm just using that as a comparison.
Oh, that
example.
Is a great comparison.
Yeah.
But I think that one thing that the court essentially did
mm-hmm.
was say, hey, we're going to shoot this back down to the states and let
right,
the states decide.
Right.
I think that's a smart move. That's really
that's the best
move they could have made
but
in
I'm
that
saying,
situation.
Though, but have you thought about a liberal court taking a gun case, let's say 5 decades from now? I'm not talking about the next couple of years. I'm talking about 50 years from now. Our country, I think, is going to go in a very different direction. And that court says, you know, localities, municipalities, or ATF, let's just say that. The ATF should be able to decide what type of guns people should and should not be able to have. I've thought about that. And this goes to the point that I was making at the early onset of this conversation. I don't think people who are on the pro side or the affirmative side, I'll use a debate term. I don't think people who are on the affirmative side of guns have done enough, in my opinion, to educate Americans on firearms. Because I'm in politics. I do see the way cultural norms change. I do see the way different elected officials are being elected today versus the ones we were electing in the past. And I can tell you, at some point, there will be a liberal court. And Eric, you and I are not too far apart age-wise. You're at last in the millennial. I'm about in the middle. But by the time I have kids who are older, and maybe my grandkids, we will have a liberal court. And there may be another gun case, Eric. And that court will not think the way you do. They will not think the way that I do. They won't think the way your audience thinks. And they will say, well, you know what? Why shouldn't the ATF be able to make these decisions? Or why shouldn't a Chicago or New York be able to decide what's in New York's interests? I think about that. And I know some people may say, well, Shermichael, that may not ever happen. We don't know that, Eric.
You ever notice in American politics and everything how everything sort of like swings on a pendulum where
that's the point
every 12 or 15 years, right? you'll have this sort of super pro America. Everyone's all red blooded American, mm-hmm. and everything's, you know, pro gun, meat eating, yeah. you know, everything. And then it swings back the other way. Like, we're dealing right now with a situation where the pendulum has swung in this really odd direction, that, and maybe even a little further than it's ever swung before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that to say that in 50 years that we're going to be in the middle of some cycle where maybe there's some super progressive driven notion that people are going to want some more gun control? I think you get into the backbone of what conservatism even is, right? Like, mm-hmm. you don't have to be right or left or Republican or Democrat or libertarian mm-hmm. to be conservative. All conservatism really means is, okay, I like my life. I like the way things are, and mm-hmm. I want things to stay the way they are. And, you know, so is that to say that maybe once the pendulum swings in a direction where people kind of start to realize, like, wow, the world's a dangerous place. The government, wow, through many, many observations, we've seen that they've done some very untrustworthy things, some things mm-hmm. that maybe we shouldn't trust them for. I mean, look, the government is comprised of human beings.
Yeah.
Human beings are fallible. We're all people. Mm-hmm. We all want the best for ourselves and our families and our communities. And look, as much as you can draw some hate at me if you want, but at the end of the day, even the people that are doing these things that we go, wow, how could someone do that? How could someone engage in this insider trading? Or how could someone weaponize a government agency against the people they don't like? But you have to remember that's the tools in their toolbox, and they're yeah. using the tools in their toolbox. Now, is that to say that in time that a larger majority of people are not going to wake up to what is going on and kind
you
of
think
go,
they
you
will?
Know, it's possible right now. Is that to say that there's a group of people that maybe they just have accepted the reality that all they want to do is be pacified and have the appearance of safety, but not the actual comfort of real safety,
mm-hmm.
right? When I look at safety, I think, hey, I've got a gun by my bed. My wife's good. Like, hey, if I go out of town, my wife has got a gun. She can protect herself. The dogs are here. So everyone has their different view of what they deem as being safety.
Yeah.
One person may say, well, I think if we just had some law on a piece of paper that said guns are illegal, that now all of a sudden all the criminals are not going to have guns. But we know, of course, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the more people start to see the reality and cruelty of the world and the infallibility of human nature, like human beings, well, the fallibility. Humans are fallible,
yeah.
and they're mm-hmm. weak creatures, and they do things, you know, in moments of weakness that are terrible. They commit acts of violence. They rob people. Acts of desperation, right? It's only human to do whatever your last cry is in life to try and get some form of, you know, help in your
world.
You're
more optimistic than I am.
And perhaps I'm optimistic.
Can I tell you why, though?
Right.
I mean, again, I'm going to go back to my background as a political strategist. I look at Generation Z, generation that's behind us millennials. Although Eric always likes to say he's on the edge of millennial and Generation X. Gen Z, majority of them do not think the way we do, Eric, based on every amount of data we have available. They do not. And for me, I look at culture and how culture shifts and how culture develops and how culture changes. And I hear everything you're saying. And I want to be as aspirational and optimistic as you are. I'm just not, though. I'm going to be honest. And I think this is a bit of a different conversation, but this is where we get into how people parent, the values they instill in their children, the demands that they make in the classrooms, the demands that they make as far as our culture in general,
sure.
what we accept in our music, what we accept from our movies, from our video games. And I'm not saying you can't play Grand Theft Auto. I love Grand Theft Auto. But what I'm saying is, Eric.
Which one?
All of them, dude. I'm waiting for the newest one.
I like Miami Vice.
That one was good. I mean, well, I'm not going to
anyway,
get into games.
Anyway.
Yeah, because you're about to go down a rabbit hole. But
anyway.
The point that I'm trying to make, Eric, is that you look at Gen Z and their views are incredibly progressive. And they're young. You're talking about kids that are teenagers. But so at some point, they're going to be voting adults. And it's a lot of them. And in 50 years, you hope that idea, that tradition that, oh, everyone's a little liberal when they're young, but they become conservative as they age. A little liberal is not the same as progressive.
I always think of Thomas Sowell when I think of that.
Yeah, but it's not progressive,
though. In his younger years, he was a Marxist. And then later in life, kind of
he became conservative.
Went down the rabbit hole, you know.
But and there are people who are like Dr. Sowell. But, Eric, I'm not convinced, man, that many of the values that I think are conservative, the values of aesthetics, the values of education, all of the values that I would traditionally subscribe to conservative intellectuals like Immanuel Kant or people like Edmund Burke or Robert Nozick or Michael Oakeshott or Sir Roger Scruton. And I would highly recommend your audience, if you are conservative, then you should understand the foundation of your beliefs intellectually. I don't think that those beliefs are really valued today the way they were in the past. And I merely say that by looking at the data on the generation behind us. And sure. So I do worry a lot about when you think about firearms or any other liberty. I do worry that this generation is going to have a radically different idea of freedom and happiness and justice and equality, sure. All of these things. And when I think about that in the context of guns, which is what we're talking about, I don't know, Eric, if those kids, when they become adults in 20 or 30 years, will agree with Eric and Shermichael that the world is a dangerous place and therefore we should be able to protect ourselves versus the world is a dangerous place and the government has the responsibility of protecting us. And those are two radically different ideas about values. And I worry about that, man. I really do.
I think that it is very intelligent and forward thinking to think about it from a perspective of how bad things could be rather than how good you want things to be. Mm-hmm. So that's smart. And I would say also to the effect of what you mentioned, Shermichael, is that when we look at danger in society and who wants who to deal with the danger, whether it is the individual who's going to have the firearm on their person and deal with the danger as they see it in front of them, mm-hmm. or whether we see a situation where, okay, let's say that 50 years from now, the ultra progressives, they put a stopper in the Second Amendment or mm-hmm. we get a super liberal packed court or they pack the courts.
Yeah. Because that conversation has come up.
You know, Manchin, we have Manchin to thank for that, a Democrat, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The point is, all right, what happens when we give a monopoly on violence to the government and then they can't deliver on it? Well, okay, the crime's still going to be crazy. You mm-hmm. still can't protect yourself. So I almost wonder if maybe situation will dictate that these folks may not have a choice, right? If the economy crashes or if we're invaded by another military power mm-hmm. or there's some catastrophic far-reaching event such as a nuclear attack or some really terrible natural disaster or perhaps an EMP or some type of a grid lockdown or hackers, like, you know, you could have Chinese hackers take out the grid and we're powerless for 90 days or 120 days or for some extended period of time, mm-hmm. right? What about sabotage on hydroelectric dams? Yeah. I mean, there are so many things that are required for the world that we know and we live in to mm-hmm. exist, mm-hmm. right? So many logistical ongoings, if you will, that have to happen in order for your iPhone to be charged and your Amazon package to arrive in 24 hours after mm-hmm. you order it and mm-hmm. for you to go to multiple places all over the country and be able to buy fuel and snacks and groceries and coffee and all the logistics. So, you know, could we see a situation where the absolute utter breakdown of civilized society makes it to where no matter what your view on guns are, if you don't have one, you're probably going to be in an extreme disadvantage, and you won't have
circumstances will force it.
Circumstances must dictate.
Yeah, that's a
so
good point.
What if we see some far-reaching, crazy geopolitical crisis happen even in the next decade that could make guns not only an idea that are not taboo to a wide variety of people, but that are actually like, wow, we need to learn about this. You know, we need to figure out more. We need to figure, you know, hey, what kind of gun do I need to buy? Like, we notice mm-hmm. on our channel that a lot of my content that poses those questions has a lot of traffic. Like, people are actively searching out, like, hey, what gun should I buy? How do I identify different ammo? How do I identify this and identify that? So there is a very increased interest in firearms. And I'm not saying that that's just some platitude that should just pacify us like a little sucker. We're going to, suck on it. But mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the point is, though, I think that it's healthy and reasonable to mm-hmm. assume the worst when it comes to how things could look 50 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also the reality of human nature. We may find that America may be a very different place 50 years from now in a way that we could never expect. It could be catastrophically different.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
this system
based
may
on
not
the, based exist. On based on Eric, based on our current trajectory, that's not beyond believe.
And at the end of the day, Sherm, at the end of the day, Sherm, there could be some law that says that I shouldn't have this AR on the wall right here. But at the end of the day, if the crap hits the fan, that AR on the wall is there.
Somebody's going to wish
it. It's right there.
Yeah.
And it ain't going nowhere. I don't have to feed it. I don't have to take care of it. Yeah. I don't have to babysit it or coddle it. It could sit there for as long as I need it to sit there. So it's a tool. It's an asset. It's a tool shed. You know, they can pass all the laws they want, but at the end of the day, whoever's got the guns has got the guns.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that – I think politics is complicated, man. And
it is.
I just tell people, you know, if you have an issue that you care about vehemently, just try to educate other people about it.
Sure.
And don't go in it with the expectation that you're going to win everybody over, because you're not. Trust me, you're not. That's why I've lost some campaigns I've been a part of. Don't go into it with the hope that you're going to open someone's mind. Because as I told you earlier, an open mind is better than a closed one. And at least if someone's open to an idea that drastically, fundamentally changes the conversation versus them being completely opposed to it. And while I would love to win as many people's minds as possible, I'm more interested in sharing some information, maybe turning on a light bulb, and maybe a person thinking to themselves, you know, maybe I thought a little incorrectly on that issue.
Or maybe the people in question that engage in these activities are not as bad as we thought they were. I mean, like what I always tell people in my videos all the time, when I'm dealing with anti-gunners, you know, I always tell people, look, hey, if you're anti-gunner and you're watching this video, like, I care about your safety. I care about your family. Sure. Like, I want you to be safe. Like, I care about you. Like, I don't think, oh, well, if someone is dumb enough to be anti-gun or to put them into that position, oh, you're dumb if you're anti-gun. Well, maybe you just don't have the information you need yet. It doesn't mean that someone's a terrible person because they have some anti-gun view or whatever, but it doesn't mean their safety isn't important. It doesn't mean that they shouldn't protect themselves. I mean, if someone were, let's say, anti-gun and we're scared of people with guns, wouldn't the sort of antithesis be to actually own a gun yourself?
Yeah.
So you can protect yourself against these evil gun owners that you're saying are out there. I mean, like, I always go off of like what I can witness, what I can see, what I can verify.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And it's like if the news cycle is telling me that black and white people hate each other, or if the news cycle is telling me that there's hatred towards trans people, or if the news cycle is telling me that whatever trope. Put whatever trope you want in there. Whatever trope there is, anti-gun, pro-gun, debacles between religious groups, debacles between different cultural divisions, whatever it may be. All I can do is go about my day and go, all right, do I see this in my life? Yeah. Now, maybe my situation is different. Maybe I just don't live in a place where these things are happening. Is that to say that those types of things aren't happening in some microcosm that they're choosing to, like you said, shine a really bright lens on to draw attention to it, just just to establish the narrative mechanism that it provides to them? Or can I go, all right, this is all bogus because I don't see this crap here? I mean, that's all a person can do. Everyone's situation is different.
Everybody has a choice. You can try to find solutions, or you can be a part of the problem. You can complain about stuff, or you can try to be a part of, once the solution is found, moving it forward. And I always like to be a part of the solution team. Let's figure out a way to make this better. Let's figure out a way to educate people. And again, I say, when I made the statement of, you know, we're not trying to win everybody over because it's just impossible, but we can educate everybody.
Yeah.
I'll give you this quick example. I know we're getting ready to wrap here.
Sure.
But over 60, I think it's like 67% of Americans read at a sixth grade level. 67%. And I'm not making fun of anybody who can't read. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that a lot of Americans don't read, Eric. They don't know what's going on. You look at some of the, I'm sure you've seen the videos on YouTube of how Americans can't pass a basic U.S. civics test. People don't even know how our own government operates. And yet we are to assume, to like you said, that they know about the nuances of what's going on with gun laws. I don't think they do, man. And so I think the burden on us is to try to educate more Americans on what's going on, why these things are important. And I think if we enlighten people and turn on that flashlight, then people are going to begin to think, well, you know, maybe the stuff that I've been seeing isn't exactly true. Maybe I need to investigate this a little bit more. And I think as we do that, you start to win more and more people over, especially those folks who are undecided. And I think there are far more of them than anybody else.
That's a good point, Sherm. So I just want to end today's gun gripe by sort of dancing around what he just mentioned about, okay, you can either be part of the problem or part of the solution. I will give you a third option. All right. So look, here's the thing. You may not understand what the solution is going to be. Maybe you can't articulate what the solution is. Maybe you don't know the answer. but maybe you also know that by staying out of the way, you won't be part of the problem either. So sometimes look, it's okay to not know. It's okay to not know. It's okay to go, hey, I don't have the information necessary to have an opinion on this and to be mature enough to go, well, you know what? I don't really dig what this guy's saying. I don't dig what them people are saying. I'm not convinced yet. It's okay to not be convinced. Mm-hmm. But when you're on the sidelines, guess what? You're not in the pit getting muddy either. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to say, you know what? I don't want to harm the situation by being part of the problem, but I don't understand the solution either. So I'm going to stand back and let the solution people do their magic. That's okay.
Yeah.
It's all right. It's okay. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make you a sheep. It doesn't make you a bad person. Mm-hmm. It just means, hey, maybe there's some self-improvement that needs to happen there. Yeah. And you got to be man or woman enough to admit, hey, I need to improve on this. Mm-hmm. I need to improve my basis for this knowledge, like to receive the knowledge.
Yeah.
So, great conversation, Sherm.
Yeah, man, we got into a lot of nuance with this. I didn't think we were going to get this deep, but I hope the people enjoyed it. I hope.
Yeah, man. Dude, so I know we're kind of late in the video. I'll post your information like kind of towards the beginning of the video.
Yeah, that's cool.
But tell everybody where they can find you.
Yeah, and follow you. You can follow me on Twitter at @ShermichaelUnderscore. I have a SiriusXM radio show, the Shermichael Singleton Show, Sirius 126, every Saturday, 2 to 3. I check out Guns Out TV on YouTube, and I just started my own YouTube channel where I break down politics. So if you like politics and you're like, I don't really trust the news, but you kind of want to hear analysis from someone who's actually been in politics, the Shermichael Singleton on YouTube. Eric will have the link. Check me out. I appreciate it.
Check them all down in the description box below. I'll put all of Shermichael's particulars down there. So, Sherm, thanks so much for being on the channel.
Dude, this was good, man. This is a great conversation. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
You're always welcome. You've always got an open mic here, and I hope that you're going to be back for way more episodes.
Oh, of course. Come on.
All right. Guys, have yourselves a great day. Many more videos on the way. We'll see you soon. Make sure you subscribe. Click that notification bell. And again, you can use the code IV8888 over on CMMG to get yourself a nice discount if you want to support the sponsor of today's show. So thank you so much. Many more videos on the way. We'll see you soon.